You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to History of the Second World War, episode 171, The Invasion of Norway, The Naval Battles of Narvik. This week, a big thank you goes out to SJD and Mary for choosing to become members of the podcast. You can find out more over at historyofthesecondworldwar.com/members. At Narvik in northern Norway, the opening hours of the German invasion had went about as well as any German officer could have hoped. The first risk that was faced by the German troops was that the Norwegian shore batteries that the Germans believed existed to guard the approaches to Narvik might have opened fire, but they did not cause any damage, because they did not exist. The second risk was that the Norwegians would mount a strong defense of a depot at Evengardsmoen, which would prevent the German troops from utilizing the supplies and weapons there for their own purposes. The Norwegians did not do this, and in fact, there were precisely 17 Norwegians at the depot when the Germans arrived. The third risk was that the city of Narvik itself would not be captured in the opening hours of the invasion, preventing the Germans from using the harbor facilities to resupply their troops and defend their gains. This would also not be a problem, and very quickly, Narvik would fall to the Germans. So that means that none of these risks would result in a problem, most of which we discussed back in episode 8. The German units were very fortunate that the invasion went very well, but they were not out of danger. And in fact, the Germans at Narvik, both on the sea and on land, would be the only units of the German army that were in real danger in the days after April 8th. This episode is about that danger. Over the course of April 10th through the 13th, there would be two separate but linked naval engagements that would occur in the approaches to Narvik and in the harbor itself. The end result of these battles would be the destruction of the German destroyers. While the initial invasion of Narvik had went very well, even right from the beginning, there were some problems that would lead to disaster for the German destroyers that had been instrumental in the operation. The first problem was around fuel. Due to the range of Narvik from the ports in Germany, the destroyers that arrived in Narvik were dangerously short of fuel, which was expected. The plan was for three supply ships to arrive in Narvik before the invasion started, with these three ships loaded down with supplies, including fuel, for the destroyers. This put the destroyers in a very rough spot because these supply ships did not arrive, because on average they needed 600 tons of fuel before they could even start the trip back to Germany. There was one German merchant ship in Narvik, the Jan Willem. And it did have extra fuel, but it was not exactly what the German destroyers needed. But without other options, the fuel began to be moved into the destroyers, although it had to be mixed with diesel oil before it could be used, which took a lot of time. Because of the slow refueling process, instead of leaving Narvik on April 9th, which is what the plan called for, by the end of that day, only three of the German destroyers had been refueled enough to make the trip back to Germany, which meant if they left, they'd have to leave all the others behind. The good news for the German ships is that they were not totally out of fuel. They would have enough for at least some defensive actions in the waters around Narvik, although the exact amount of fuel that every German destroyer had was pretty variable. The second problem that the German plans did not foresee was the situation with the defenses at the entrances to Offutfjord on the way to Narvik. German intelligence believed that there were strong Norwegian shore batteries sighted to fire out over the fjord, and there had been a dedicated landing specifically to capture them and prevent them from firing on the German ships as they approached Narvik. They then also planned to use those guns to defend against the expected attack from the Royal Navy. This was important because the German forces that had landed in Narvik did not have any really heavy weapons. It would have been nice to have those heavy weapons, but they could not be transported aboard destroyers. There was just one problem that the Germans would have to contend with around this plan to use these shore batteries. The Norwegian coastal batteries did not exist, and in fact, there were no defenses at the entrances of the Offutt Fjord. Instead, there were only Norwegian plans to eventually build the positions, which did not exactly help the German forces, as they would soon be forced to hold off an attack from the Royal Navy. The attack would be launched by the 2nd Destroyer Flotilla, commanded by Captain Warburton Lee. The destroyers under Warburton Lee had established a patrol line across the entrances to Narvik on April 9th, which would have prevented any German ships from leaving, but was too late to prevent them from getting to Narvik in the first place. Beyond just patrolling the entrances, the path forward for Warburton Lee was difficult to determine. What was known is that he had 5 destroyers under his command, but the exact number and size of the German ships that he faced was kind of unknown. He believed that he was outnumbered and that there was a superior force in Narvik that he would have to contend with, and this fact made him more cautious. But back in London, there was slightly less caution being applied to the orders given to Warburton Lee, with the following message sent from the Admiralty at around midday on the 9th. Quote, "Press reports state one German ship has arrived in Narvik and landed a small force. Proceed to Narvik and sink or capture enemy ship. It is at your discretion to land forces if you think you can recapture Narvik from number of enemy present. Try to get possession of battery if not already in enemy hands." End quote. I believe that last bit is around some Norwegian shore batteries that were in and around Narvik. Now, of course, we know that this Admiralty report was totally wrong. There was a lot more than only one ship. But just before 6 p.m., Warburton Lee would send the following signal back to the Admiralty as a way of both recognizing the desire of those in London to see him attack, while also making it clear that he believed he would be outnumbered. Quote, "Norwegians report Germans holding Narvik in force. Also 6 destroyers and 1 U-boat are there, and channel is possibly mined. Intend attacking at dawn high water." End quote. The response from the Admiralty would end with the simple phrase, "Attack at dawn. All good luck." End quote. Warburton Lee had made it clear that he believed he was outnumbered, but he was still going to attack, and the Admiralty just said, "Go get him, tiger." Shortly after the British destroyers began their attack, though, up the fjord around midnight, there was another message that arrived from the Admiralty. Quote, "Norwegian defense ships may be in German hands. You alone can judge whether, in these circumstances, attack should be made. We shall support whatever decision you make." End quote. Now, this seems to show clear signs of hesitancy from the Admiralty, even after their firm message for action just around 6 hours before. In this case, it did not matter because Warburton Lee had committed to the attack. But the inability of the Admiralty, and really most British leaders, to stay the course after a decision had been made would be one of the major British challenges during the Norwegian campaign. In this case, their hesitancy would not matter, because Warburton Lee had tried to time the movement of his destroyers up the fjord so that they arrived shortly after first light, and they would be largely successful in this. As they arrived at the harbor entrance, there was just enough light to see that there were a large number of ships at anchor in Narvik Harbor, but it was difficult to determine the position of those German destroyers. The plan of attack was for the British destroyers to enter the harbor one at a time and launch their attacks, and the first ship to do so would be the Hardy, commanded by Warburton Lee himself. It would find 2 German destroyers stationary in the harbor, and a set of torpedoes would be launched. After firing its torpedoes, the Hardy turned and headed back to the entrance. The first torpedo would miss the German destroyers and hit a merchant ship anchored nearby, but the second would hit the Wilhelm Heidkamp. When the torpedo impacted the German destroyer, the resulting explosion was a wake-up call to everybody nearby, because the aft magazine of the German destroyer detonated, blowing off a huge chunk of the stern of the ship and killing the entire 82-man crew pretty much instantly. The next British ship in the harbor was the Hunter, with its commander mostly just throwing off all of his torpedoes at a large group of ships in the harbor before beginning to fire at the destroyers with his guns. One of the torpedoes would hit a German destroyer, the Anton Schmidt, The Anton Schmidt did not immediately explode or sink like the Wilhelm Heidkamp, but it would then be hit by another torpedo, this time from the third British destroyer, the Havoc. After the second torpedo hit the German destroyer, the ship broke into two pieces, with the forward piece rolling over and getting hopelessly entangled in the upper works of the Hermann Kuhn, another German destroyer. After firing a few rounds at the Hermann Kuhn, the Havoc also exited the harbor, and the five British destroyers began to just circle around the entrance to the harbor. They would continue to fire at the German ships whenever they came around to the entrance, but they had to keep moving due to the number of German torpedoes that had been fired towards them and towards the entrance of the harbor. During this time, the remaining German destroyers also began to enter into a gun duel with the British ships. At this point, the faulty British intelligence that Warburton Lee was operating under became a serious problem. The British believed that there were six German destroyers at Narvik, and they knew that they had destroyed or incapacitated at least four of them with torpedoes and guns. Therefore, Warburton Lee decided now was the time to press home the attack, and the British destroyers moved into line ahead formation and moved into the harbor at 20 knots. In the harbor, they mostly just circled and fired at everything that looked even mildly threatening for several minutes before exiting. Up until this point, the British destroyers had some very good luck. They had sustained no serious damage by German gunfire, and they had dodged many torpedoes. They even had multiple torpedoes head underneath their keel because they were running too deep. The decision was made to go into the harbor for a third time, again with the intent of ensuring that they had finished off all German opposition. It would be this exact decision that would turn a spotless British victory into a much more costly battle. All of the British actions after the first trip into the harbor had been dictated by the belief that they had disabled or sunk all but maybe one or two of the German ships, but that was absolutely not the case. And on their third trip into the harbor, they were confronted with their error. There were in fact five German destroyers that were not in Narvik Harbor at all, with three of them being to the northeast and two of them to the southwest. They would make their presence known as the British destroyers exited the harbor after their third attack. And as the British destroyers moved west, the German destroyers were now in hot pursuit. The first German destroyers were the three from the northeast, which would enter into a gun duel with the retreating British destroyers. Both sides would be largely ineffective with their gunfire during this phase, partially due to the smoke screen put down by British ships. But then the second group of German destroyers, the two from the southwest, the George Teal and the Bernard von Arnhem, appeared, coming from the west. Suddenly, the British ships found themselves in an equal fight in terms of numbers, but in a much worse position due to the arrangement of their forces. Due to the smoke screen that the British destroyers had been laying down, only the first two ships in the British line, the Hardy and the Havoc, even knew that the German destroyers had appeared in front of them. It was at roughly this exact moment that British luck, that had served them so well over the previous hours, completely ran out. Just before 6 a.m., Warburton Lee would signal to all the British destroyers, "Keep on engaging the enemy," but time was running out. The George Teal would hit the Hardy with its fourth gun salvo, hitting the bridge and the wheelhouse, and then destroying the forward turrets. Everyone on the bridge was either killed or wounded, and the ship went out of control, eventually running ashore on a rocky beach near Varick. The gun duel continued, with the British also landing some shots on their German foes. For example, on board the George Teal, one of the boilers was knocked out, and another hit required the flooding of the aft magazine to prevent its explosion by fire. The British destroyers were worse off, though, in basically all instances, with the Hunter and Hotspur being hit several times by German fire, and the Hunter catching fire. The George Teal would move in and pump round after round into the Hunter until eventually it was a flaming wreck that came to a stop. The Hotspur was the next to be hit, with a German shell destroying communication and hydraulics, including the steering. This resulted in the Hotspur taking a violent and uncontrolled turn right into the Hunter. After this final bit of destruction, the George Teal would exit the battle after being hit at least seven times, it was on fire, and two of its magazines were now flooded. The Hostel and the Havoc were the only two fully functional British destroyers at this point. However, the Hunter was able to start moving west again after regaining control of its steering. It was still heavily damaged, but the Havoc and Hostel moved in behind the damaged destroyer and were able to escort it out of harm's way. The German victory could have been greater, but due to the fuel situation, the German destroyers were forced to call off the chase, with a few of the German ships down to their last gallons of fuel. as the two groups of destroyers broke contact, there was another happy little accident for the British, a return of their luck, perhaps, because as the British destroyers were leaving the fjord, they encountered the German supply ship Roenfels, which was making its way into Narvik with the explicit purpose of resupplying the German destroyers. But the British destroyers fired their guns at the ship after it refused signals to stop. The German supply ship caught fire and the crew abandoned it. The British destroyers would actually stop and put a boarding party aboard the German ship, although they would soon return to their British destroyers so that the ship could be destroyed. Two more shells were fired into the German ship, which apparently exploded quite spectacularly. With the explosion of the Roenfels, the first naval battle of Narvik was over. Both sides had lost two destroyers, with several other destroyers damaged. The Germans had lost a few more men, 176 to 147, but more importantly, for the overall course of the campaign, the ability of the German destroyers to mount a defense of Narvik had been drastically reduced. There were less of their destroyers still afloat, that was a major thing, but also they'd used a large portion of their ammunition, and their fuel situation had deteriorated even further.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
After the first naval battle of Narvik, the German destroyers were in a rough spot. Ammunition was low, and the possibility of any additional supply ships arriving was also very low, due to the British control of the entrances into Narvik. A message would be sent to German naval command that there could only be two German destroyers ready to leave the fjord on April 10th, mostly due to only having two destroyers refueled and relatively undamaged. These two ships were the Wolfgang Zenker and the Erich Geese. Leaving on April 10th was important because it was on that date that the two German battleships, Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, would be on their way back to Germany, which would make the path back to Germany far safer for the destroyers. Even though only two destroyers were prepared, the orders that were given by Naval High Command was for them to break out and meet up with the German battleships on the 10th. But it was already too late, because as soon as the destroyers began to leave Narvik, they would find the end of the fjord patrolled by British ships, making breakout impossible. The two destroyers were forced to simply turn around and go back to Narvik. Over the course of the next day, three more German destroyers were made ready to leave. Unfortunately, two of them would then run aground on April 12th. While the Germans were trying to prepare for some kind of breakout attempt, on the British side, they had become far more cautious in their approach to Narvik. After the first engagement, the surprising strength of the German forces had caused the British to swing the opposite direction, and instead of underestimating German strength, they were now overestimating it by quite a bit. On April 12th, the belief was that there were two German cruisers and five or six German destroyers still remaining in Narvik. If this was true, a far stronger British force was required if another attack was to be possible. It couldn't just be a handful of destroyers again. The force assembled would eventually include nine British destroyers and the battleship Warspite. On April 13th, the British ships would move in, preceded by a reconnaissance aircraft launched by the Warspite. The aircraft not only spotted two of the German destroyers, but also was able to execute a dive bombing attack on the U-boat U-64, sinking the German submarine. The spotting of the German destroyers was fortunate because the entire German plan revolved around surprise, and because of the reconnaissance, surprise was no longer possible. The plan was for those two destroyers to launch the attack right around an island. But as soon as the British destroyers came around the island, they instantly started firing because they knew the German ships were already there. The remaining five German destroyers did not wait for the British attack in Narvik Harbor, but would instead sail out to the west. Fire was opened by both sides at around 17,000 meters, although at such a range it was mostly ineffective. Even though the gun duel would continue for over an hour, it would result in almost no damage. But the path of the battle would push the German destroyers further and further into the fjord, and they were eventually going to run out of room. The Erik Geese would eventually get hit by several shells, and it would begin to burn, which forced the German captain to order the ship to be abandoned. Three of the British destroyers then entered into the Narvik harbor and would begin firing on the Dieter von Ruder, which was immobile due to engine problems. The Warspite joined in on the firing on the destroyer, and eventually it would be forced to beach itself to avoid sinking, although it would be able to hit the British destroyer Cossack with seven shells before it was put out of action. While three of the British destroyers had moved into Narvik, the other destroyers had continued to pursue the remaining German destroyers up the fjord. By this point, two of the German ships were out of ammunition, and the others were running low. The next several minutes of fighting would mostly just involve the German ships firing the last of their ammunition, launching the last of their torpedoes, and then moving up into a small fjord and scuttling themselves. The George Teal would act as a rearguard, being the last German ship with ammunition, and it would continue to engage the British ships as long as possible to give the other German destroyers time to scuttle themselves. The very last torpedo from the George Teal would hit the British destroyer Eskimo. This would cause a lot of damage on the Eskimo, but the George Teal would then come under fire from all of the assembled British destroyers, and the German destroyer would be forced to run aground. After the final German destroyer was neutralized, there was at least a brief consideration given to trying to land troops in Narvik. But all the British ships had on board were naval personnel, and they'd been in action all day. And so instead, the assembled British ships would simply bombard some of the expected German troop concentrations, although there would be no recorded casualties on the German side. The British ships would stay near Narvik overnight, and the survivors of the Hardy that had been able to reach the shore during the earlier battle were actually able to board some of the British destroyers and be evacuated after they'd been cared for by local Norwegians during the previous days. The end of the second battle would be the end of the German destroyers at Narvik, with all 10 either sunk, scuttled, or run aground to prevent being sunk. This was bad for the sailors, but also bad for the German Navy as a whole. The 10 destroyers at Narvik represented almost half of the total destroyers in the Kriegsmarine, and they would never recover from the losses suffered during the two naval battles of Narvik. All of the survivors, around 2,000 men, were turned into infantrymen, and largely armed with weapons gained from Norwegian supplies captured during the invasion. This doubled the number of ground troops in and around Narvik, although of course the naval men were not as effective as the dedicated ground troops that had been landed during the invasion. But more importantly, it meant that they were almost completely cut off from any help from Germany. They could maybe get some help from the air, but from the sea, they had to contend with the Royal Navy, and if they wanted to try and move out of Narvik and move south, they had to deal with the Norwegian geography, that Norway itself would fight against them. And so the thousands of German troops that were in Narvik and around Narvik were mostly just sitting ducks, waiting to see what the British, French, and Norwegians would do.